WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. The Republican Party platform condemns the use of public funds to subsidize, quote, obscenity and blasphemy masquerading as art. That point of view is one of the reasons John Frohnmayer is no longer the head of the National Endowment for the Arts. He couldn't support the Bush administration's sanctions against public funding of controversial art, and he was forced out last spring. He was appointed head of the agency in 1989. During his tenure, he was caught in the middle between the religious right and the arts community. The right thought he didn't do enough to crack down on homoerotic and sexually explicit art. The arts community accused him of vetoing grants to controversial artists, while adding an anti-obscenity pledge, which artists accepting money had to sign. This was in compliance with the Helms Amendment, which outlawed federal funding of obscene art. The anti-obscenity clause recently was found unconstitutional. After Frohnmayer left the NEA, he became more outspoken on First Amendment issues. I asked him if he left the NEA feeling more strongly about the First Amendment than when he started.
I did. I had been a First Amendment lawyer. About 20% of my practice in Portland had been with television and newspaper interests. But it became a very different First Amendment, sort of an existential awakening, I suppose, when I realized that I had the power in my job to really affect people's speech and the amount of freedom that they had. And so while I was a First Amendment moderate when I came in, I really left as a First Amendment radical, feeling that it was the keystone of what makes our country free.
Are there decisions you made as a First Amendment moderate that you're now sorry you made as a First Amendment radical?
Well, I think that what I did, I really did the best I could with the information and the position that I was in on each of those decisions. But all of us look back at what we have done in the past and think of ways we could have done it better. I think that's part of the human condition, and it's also part of what inspires us to do better the next time.
Is there any one thing, though, that you wish you could do differently than you did when you were there?
I really wouldn't pinpoint anything except to say that I am writing a book about this, and that there will be, I mean, I do intend in that book to be as honest as I can about the decisions that I made.
Now, you left the NEA shortly after Pat Buchanan, during his primary campaign, called the NEA the upholstered playpen of the arts and crafts auxiliary of the Eastern liberal establishment, and he attacked the NEA for funding filthy and blasphemous art. Now, do you think you were asked to leave in response to that particular attack?
Yes, I do. It was specifically mentioned on my exit interview.
With Sam Skinner?
Yeah.
He was the chief of staff who, as you put it, handed you your hat. Can you tell us something? What happened at that meeting when he...
Well, basically, Sam called me in. He and I had never met. It wasn't much of a secret to me what the meeting was going to be about, although he didn't announce it when he said he needed to see me right away. And then he said, I understand from the president that you're intending to leave, and we danced around that for a while. I told him that I wanted to stay until I got some projects completed and that I had talked to the president about that, and it was fine with the president. And the crux of it was, he said, I want you to announce your resignation tomorrow. And then basically he said that Pat Buchanan had started these attacks and that I didn't want to be the target of that bully for the rest of the primary campaign season. Of course, as far as I was concerned, Pat Buchanan was only the latest in a series of arts terrorists that had been on the case of the endowment ever since I had been there.
Did you consider asking Skinner to fire you instead of asking you to leave so everything would be really upfront and it would be really clear what was happening?
Well, I don't think there was any question about what happened. It was it was a firing.
Right. Now, I had read, and you can tell me if this is true, that John Sununu, the former chief of staff, had tried to get rid of you earlier in the fall of 1991.
There is no, there wasn't any mystery about Sununu's position either. I don't know whether he had taken steps to try to get rid of me. Certainly there were press reports of that sort of thing. But I think that both Sununu and Skinner were reflective of the administration's failure or inability to recognize the value of controversy in our society.
Did you expect the National Endowment for the Arts to be a political football when you accepted the position as its head?
It was at the time that I accepted the position. What I didn't expect was for it to continue with as much scrutiny and as much intensity for the entire time that I was there.
The NEA is supposed to be insulated from political concerns. Why isn't it?
Well, I suppose that the surprising thing is that it has been so insulated over the first 25 years of its existence. It's really only in the last 3 years or so that it has become such a political football, and I think that's so for two reasons. On the one hand, those who so fiercely and publicly and fearlessly defended it on the basis of the necessity, not just for the arts, but for our whole society, that all voices be heard. Those voices have really been quelled over the last 3 years, and you can see that in the kinds of statements that appeared on the House and Senate floor in 1989, as opposed to those in 1991 or 1992. And the other side of it is that the fundamentalist right, the radical right, if you will, is far better organized now than it has ever been before, and it has pointed toward this issue as some way to continue to replenish their coffers since the specter of international communism has vanished.
Is there something that isn't working within the system? I mean, that thing that is supposed to keep the NEA insulated from politics, obviously it's not working that way. Is there something within that mechanism that's going wrong?
There's nothing wrong with the mechanism. There's something wrong with the individual courage of the people that are buckling under to this political, cultural terrorism. It seems to me that one of the things that our whole system has succumbed to is the politics of blame as opposed to the politics of responsibility. And it seems to me that it's not threatening, really, to the American scene to allow culture to be free. What's threatening to the American scene is the kind of narrow thinking and intolerance and misinformation that has marked the attacks on the NEA. It seems to me that that's a much greater threat to America than anything that the Arts Endowment has ever funded or ever will fund.
My guest is John Frauenmeier, and he was the chair of the NEA from 1989 until last April when he was forced out by the Bush administration. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Frauenmeier, the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. You had worked for the Bush campaign in 1988. Do you think that had to do with why you were appointed? And did the Bush administration expect political loyalty from you?
A hard question. I really had... didn't have a lot of association with the Bush campaign in 1988. I can't really speculate about why I was appointed, except I do believe that I had the qualifications to hold the job. In terms of political loyalty, it seems to me that makes sense only in the face of a program. And what I found after I joined the Bush administration was that they had no program for the arts other than to be non-controversial, and that, in fact, is no program at all.
Were you advised about what the White House expected of you?
Not really. The whole indoctrination was pretty minimal.
What did it consist of?
Well, there were some sessions at the White House for new appointees that talked about ethics and talked about not lobbying but educating Congress to points of view, that talked about open-door policies of both the president and John Sununu and things like that. And those were helpful, but they really didn't amount to sitting down with either the president or the chief of staff or, for that matter, anybody else and talking through the goals of the arts policy. And so the goals of the arts policy were really my goals as I had articulated them in my interviews and as I continued to articulate them in my confirmation message and thereafter. And seemingly that was fine with the administration, But, again, all they wanted, I don't think they really cared whether I accomplished those goals or not. What they cared was that we not pop up on their radar screens as something that they had to deal with in terms of quelling a controversy.
Why were they afraid of controversy? Because it might create fires for them that they'd have to put out? Did it have to do with the arts, or did it just have to do with not wanting controversy?
Well, I think it had to do at its root with what I consider to be an unnatural and unnecessary and really quite unfortunate inclination of this administration to kowtow to the demands of the radical right.
It's been reported that John Sununu, who was then White House Chief of Staff, and William Kristol, who is Dan Quayle's Chief of Staff, wanted you to draw up a blacklist of artist troublemakers. Is that true?
I do write about that in my book, and I'd rather not answer it at this point, but I think I'll leave it at that.
When you left the NEA, you said that you thought your successor would be a decency czar. Anne Radice has been serving as the interim head of the NEA. Do you think she's been serving as a decency czar?
I can't answer that question. The only thing that I know is that immediately after she was empowered, she vetoed two grants on the basis of their sexual content, apparently. It was apparent to me that she was acting on orders from the White House to go in and take charge and show how tough she was. I think that that's a poor way to run a railroad, frankly. It seems to me that artistic excellence and artistic merit are the only way that one can really justify the endowment's existence. And if you start giving grants on bases other than that, then the whole endowment is compromised.
She was appointed as your deputy during your tenure at the NEA. Did you ever feel that she was there to keep watch over you or to report back to the Bush administration?
Well, I definitely felt that.
What gave you that feeling?
Well, it was clear to me that she was 100% political, and in fact, she said as much. And I do know that she had conversations with people in the White House about what was going on in the endowment, and I knew from various statements of people that she had talked to outside the White House that there were really two agendas going on, my agenda for the endowment and her desire to be politically responsible to the White House.
What do you think she was reporting back?
I really can't speculate on that.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the religious right, which pressured the Bush administration to crack down on the NEA. Christianity Today, the publication, reported in June of 1990 that the National Association of Evangelicals tried to work with you to fashion mutually acceptable solutions. What was that like?
Well, it was short-lived, unfortunately. I talked to the evangelical leaders at the White House, actually, at one point. And then we did talk with some of their leadership. But I think that their expectation about, I'm not sure entirely what their expectations were, we're not very realistic if one believes in the First Amendment. It's curious to me, actually, that the First Amendment which protects religion is also the First Amendment which protects speech, and particularly speech which may be dissident or may be unpopular. And many of the religious groups that were hard after the endowment seem to care very little about the freedom of speech of those people with whom they happen to disagree.
You've indicated that the mainstream churches were unfortunately absent from the debate about the arts. What would you have liked to hear from mainstream churches?
Something. Almost anything. I think that it's highly unfortunate that the fundamentalists got to set the agenda on this whole issue. What they claimed to be blasphemous was widely accepted to be so by people of goodwill in churches around the country and by members of Congress and members of the administration. And let me give you an example. One of the pieces that seemed to cause the most distress on the part of Reverend Wildman was a piece that he took out of context from a large collage by David Wanorowicz. And Wildman took a little image of Jesus with a crown of thorns and a needle in his arm out of that larger collage, and sent that image to everybody in Congress, and I don't know who all else, and said, this is blasphemous. Well, that image, if you look at it, is Christ with a needle in his arm, but the arms are down. They aren't on the needle. And it seems to me that one could, in traditional Christian theology, say that's an image of Christ taking on the sins of the world. That's a statement that I would have hoped would have come from mainline Christian churches. And instead, there was nothing.
Now, you were a theological student for a while, and you have your master's degree in Christian ethics. Did any of the art that you were passing judgment on pose religious problems to you? And did you think of any of it as blasphemous? Were you offended on religious grounds?
No. To me, religion sets one free. Religion enables one to think broadly and to know that one is unconditionally loved. Theology is not something which is a negative force in my life. And I guess that's my concern about much of the fundamentalist opposition. It just seemed to be so hateful and so narrow and so sort of oppressive. And that's not the theology which I follow, nor do I believe it to be the theology or the message of Christianity.
John Frohnmayer is the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Frohnmayer. He was the chair of the NEA from 1989 until last April when he was forced out by the Bush administration. One of your most controversial actions while you were the chair of the NEA was your vetoing of the grants to four artists who have since become known as the NEA Four: Holly Hughes, Karen Finley, Tim Miller, and John Fleck. Looking back on that now, and that happened in 1990, how do you feel about that decision? It was widely interpreted as those grants were vetoed because of sexual content. A couple of the artists were gay. Several of the performances had to do with matters pertaining to gender and sexuality and sexual preference.
Well, I would say simply two things about that. One, it's in litigation, and that constrains me from talking about it to any great extent. But secondly, keep in mind that the National Council on the Arts differed from the panel. The panel recommended 18 grants. The National Council recommended 14 grants. And the National Council is not only a larger body, but a more distinguished body. And so I was faced with conflicting recommendations. Granted, I did not grant those grants, and so they were not approved, but I'm not sure I agree with the word veto. That suggests that there was some right.
I'd like for you to share your impressions of how the arts community reacted to you while you were the head of the NEA, and if you were seen as really being in the middle with the religious right on the one hand, and artists making controversial art on the other. What's your critique of how the artists making controversial art and the exhibitors showing that art, what's your critique of how they handled you politically?
Well, I don't have any recriminations to make in that regard. I think everyone views the world out of his or her peculiar circumstances. And with the artist, particularly the individual artist, it is a very tender and sometimes very lonely and precarious existence. In that sense, when an artist is attacked, you aren't just attacking the art, you're attacking the whole life of the person who is making that art. Having said that, I think that the arts world is incredibly naive in terms of the fact that we do live in a political world, and in fact many artists are making art which is very political, and to not expect to get roughed up in the hurly-burly of political or of politics is unrealistic. On the other hand, and this is what makes this issue so complicated, one really hopes that we as a society are strong enough and confident enough to be able to let the artist have that freedom of imagination and have that ability to criticize the society, because In so doing, the artists help us work through the most difficult issues that we as a society face. And they also help us to build community, because it is that dialogue, intellectual assembly that artists help us to encounter that leads us through these difficult issues and hopefully to at least a minimal consensus that will allow us as a society to not splinter apart.
John Frohnmayer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Frohnmayer is the former head of the National Endowment for the Arts. Frohnmayer will discuss art and the First Amendment this Friday and Saturday at a conference in Minneapolis, co-sponsored by the Midwest Center for Arts, Entertainment, and the Law and Hamline University School of Law.